Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly look at the issues that matter to residents of the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Juanita Stevenson.
Welcome to Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson. On our program today, a problem that impacts all of us in one way or another, the shortage of primary care doctors in the Central Valley, a report from correspondent Shelley Bronco, and a discussion about what is being done to increase the number of physicians in the Valley. Plus, as students head back to class, we look at charter schools and how they are becoming an alternative for many parents. And my conversation with the nation's new poet laureate, Fresno's Philip Levine, and I cannot tell you what a treat that was for me. But first, the Valley faces a shortage of primary care doctors and specialists. Many physicians prefer to work in urban areas where the pay is better, rather than rural clinics that serve the poor. But a program through UC Davis and UC Merced is trying to change that, encouraging Valley medical students to practice here at home. Valley Public Radio Shelley Bronco has this report.
Children and parents crowd the waiting room in the United Health Center's clinic for low-income patients in Parlier. It's a busy morning, and Dr. Rogelio Fernandez is seeing patients one right after the other. At this moment, he's treating 35-year-old Yesenia Campuzano of Reedley. The birth control implant in her arm caused acne, so Dr. Fernandez is surgically removing the tiny, tube-like device. She's feeling the incision, so she needs more of the local anesthetic.
Okay.
Okay. Dr. Fernandez practices family medicine in his hometown, in a clinic just outside the fields where many of his farmworker patients make their living. He knows it's difficult to attract doctors to rural areas with poor residents. That's why the Valley faces a shortage of primary care doctors and specialists. In the Valley, there are 173 doctors for every 100,000 residents. The Bay Area has more than double that number of physicians. Fernandez says most doctors want to live in urban areas.
That was one of the reasons that I went to medical school 20-some years ago, because I wanted to come and help in these areas that did not have enough physicians. And that is still the problem now.
A new program through UC Davis and UC Merced will create more homegrown physicians like Dr. Fernandez. The schools have created the UC Merced San Joaquin Valley Program in Medical Education, also known as PRIME, and it's the first step in creating a medical school at UC Merced. Medical students will spend their first 2 years at UC Davis. They'll spend their last 2 years in rotations at Valley clinics and hospitals. The students have to demonstrate their commitment to providing primary care to underserved patients in the Valley. PRIME classes are now in session at UC Davis. Randall Rueda of Fresno is one of the five pioneering students of the new program. When he was in high school, he recognized the lack of specialists when both of his parents became sick at the same time. His father had a borderline heart attack and didn't get the best care possible.
My mother had her hysterectomy, but she was taken care of at the hospital. So that's kind of different because she got the care that she needed beforehand. But as far as my father was concerned, as far as follow-up treatment to check up on his heart and all of those things, he didn't get a chance to access those services as quickly as I felt he should have been able to.
This semester, Rueda and the other students will take part in seminars about health disparities in the Valley. In the future, Rueda wants to practice internal medicine and possibly specialize in infectious diseases. His fellow PRIME students come from Modesto, Fowler, Salinas, and Bakersfield. Each of them received a $10,000 scholarship. PRIME is funded by a $5 million grant from the United Health Foundation, and officials hope to raise more money. Dr. Frederick Myers is the Executive Associate Dean of the UC Davis School of Medicine. He says the state doesn't have the money to support the new program or to sustain a medical school at UC Merced. But Dr. Myers looks to financial support from philanthropists and programs like PRIME to bring the school to life.
Most new medical schools in this country are developed incrementally, starting with smaller programs and building up to a full-fledged medical school, and that continues to be the plan.
Money is also one of the reasons doctors don't come to the Valley. They leave school with massive loans, and they believe Medi-Cal reimbursements for low-income patients don't pay enough. California offers a loan repayment program for doctors who serve in needy areas, but state legislators are trying to create more incentives. A current assembly bill sponsored by Democrat Henry Perea would provide scholarships to medical students who will practice in underserved locations. Culture is another roadblock. Dr. Myers says many doctors don't see the Valley as a sophisticated place to live.
Physicians are no different than everybody else. They want to raise their families in places that are safe, nonviolent, good schools, cultural activities, etc.
Back in Parlier, Dr. Fernandez says he would welcome prime students to work with him.
Those are the people that are going to stay. You're not going to get somebody to stay here who's from probably out of state, grew up in an urban area, wants to stay in an urban area. You can bring them here, but they're not going to stay.
The recession has made it harder to secure support for such programs, just as it's made it difficult for patients to afford health care. Doctors and academics say those challenges have motivated them to make this Valley Medical Program a success. I'm Shelley Bronco.
Thank you, Shelley. Shelley joins us now, and I have a couple of questions. Have the universities chosen the clinical sites or projects that the prime students will take on?
Not yet. The prime program is still in the early stages. The students are possibly going to do a study on reducing childhood obesity. That might be one of their research projects, but again, everything's in the early stages.
Well, what are the students doing right now? What else are they doing?
Well, they had an orientation a few weeks ago, just before classes, where they visited clinics in Fireball and San Joaquin. And the student I spoke to said that was very exciting. The clinics all seemed very receptive to them, and they gave them a warm welcome, and they're all excited to be part of this.
Well, great program. Let's see how it moves forward. And thank you, Shelley, for that great report.
Thank you.
Also joining us on the program is Dr. Dominique Dizon. He's the Medical Director of Ambulatory Care at Community Regional Medical Center and Associate Professor of Medicine at UCSF Fresno. Also, Steve Burrow, Director, California State Rural Health Association. I welcome both of you to the program this morning.
Thank you, Anita.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, Dr. Dizon, in your role as the Director of Ambulatory Care at Community Regional Medical Center, now it's my understanding, in this program, you all see many of the county's patients who truly can't afford medical care.
That is correct, Juanita. So as part of the plan back in 1996, the county turned over the care of indigent patients to community medical center, specific community regional medical center, and CRMC is in partnership with UCSF Fresno. And UCSF Fresno has been teaching the next generation of doctors for the Valley really since 1974.
So how many, I understand this is mainly center where primary care physicians practice.
Well, we have 8 residency programs, and 3 of them, including internal medicine, pediatrics, and family practice, do training for primary care physicians.
Now, at the center, I mean, you all must be on overload, I would assume, with all your patients.
Yes. So there's two institutes. There's the UCSF Fresno Center for Medical Research and Education, where we do our teaching, research, lectures. And then the place where we see patients is called the Darren Collegiate Ambulatory Care Center, where I work. So there we do see indigent patients who have something called MISP, Medically Indigent Special Program, as well as Medi-Cal. So patients that Dr. Rogelio Fernandez was seeing at United Health Center, if they need to see a specialist, they refer to us at the Ambulatory Care Center.
So
we see up to about 137,000 visits per year.
Wow. With how many doctors?
Well, there, we have residents that see patients there. We have attending physicians who are also professors with UCSF Fresno. So they involve also other residencies like surgery, psychiatry, OBGYN. We also have a residency in orthopedics and also in emergency medicine.
Now, the doctors that you are trying to recruit, or I should say just trying to grow.
Correct.
What kind of success are you having? Are you finding more success with students or young people who are from this area?
So, yes, since we've been doing the training since 1974, we trained more than 2,000. That's 2,000 physicians. And our mission is to get them to practice here in the Valley. And about a third of them, when they graduate, have really stayed here in the Central Valley. In fact, when we had our graduation in June, 8 out of 10 of the graduates ended up staying here. Not all of them went to primary care, but at least we have a good retention rate. And I have to say that this is really a national problem, the shortage of primary care. Unfortunately, in all medical schools in the U.S., only about 2% of medical graduates now end up choosing a primary care discipline, unfortunately.
And I do understand that it is a nationwide problem, but from what I see, it's even worse in California,
exactly,
and more so in the Central Valley.
I agree. In fact, recently, Fresno State Central Valley Health Policy Institute published a study showing that, indeed, if you divide a state into 6 regions, and we compose of the San Joaquin Valley region of 8 counties, we fare the worst in terms of total number of doctors, total number of primary care doctors, and total number of specialists, whereby we're half the state average and a third of the national average.
Mr. Brower, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. And with you being director of California State Rural Health Association, you know, we can really see this problem in our rural health clinics.
Right. I mean, it's not just in the clinics. It's in the hospitals. It affects patient care across the board. Not even enough individual doctors practicing out in communities. There is a lot of work going on to help deal with the problem. But when you're talking about the primary care doctor part of the problem, the physician part, you have to take a really long view. You have to take a 6 to 8 year view because it takes that long to train up and have doctors go through residency before they hit the pavement and they're actually in the community alone, not just in residency, but they're actually practicing in the clinics and the hospitals. And so the state is embarked on, about a year and a half ago, a major project. It's called the Healthcare Workforce Development Council. It appointed a council of experts and interest groups from around California. There's a few of us that are focused on rural on that council. I actually chair that council's subcommittee that's focused on career pathways. And we're looking at not just primary care physicians. We're looking at all healthcare occupations because you can't keep a primary care doc in place unless you have the lab specialists, the radiologists, the nurses, the administrators, the IT computer people that back them up. Doctors just don't practice in a vacuum. There's a lot of other occupations surrounding them. But the primary care doctor problem of not having enough, as the good doctor was just explaining, especially in the Central Valley, is one of the most troubling. And one of the problems is it takes a long time to turn the ship around and get,
exactly,
get things happening.
Takes a while to get through medical school,
yeah,
and then try to overcome some of the obstacles that we face. And so when you look at trying to get, and it's not just primary care doctors, I understand, it's specialists and nearly all of the fields, medical fields, but what do you do to get more young people to not only attend medical school, but choose to practice here in the Central Valley?
It has to start, like most educational situations in all occupations, you want to start really early. We want to start exposing children, even when down to the grade school, elementary school, junior high school, and high school levels, in the healthcare arena. We want to start exposing them to that's a good job path to go into. There are a lot of programs that are called pipeline programs where they increase exposure of kids to healthcare as an occupation, but not just doctors, but the whole array, hoping that a number of kids will then when they get to high school and they really start getting serious about what college they're going to go to and what they want to do, that they'll a greater percentage of them will choose healthcare, and hopefully a lot more of them will choose becoming a doctor. The problem we have, though, is that we need to gear up our medical schools, and in the Central Valley, we need to gear up greatly. The Prime program should be expanded. It's a wonderful program. It recruits, and the folks that have talked before me this morning are absolutely correct. When you recruit from rural areas, you get a better, what I call, fit and stick, where you get people that have grown up in the rural area. That's where their extended family is. That's where they're comfortable. They're more likely to fit into the community as a primary care physician once they get through the whole training. And then they stick. A lot of times right now, we have a lot of incentive programs. We have J-1 visa programs to attract foreign-trained doctors. We have National Health Service programs to attract medical students to come and work in underserved areas for a couple years. But they don't stick. After a couple years, we lose them. A great percentage of them leave the rural areas. So folks this morning that have talked about rural recruitment and planning for that, and then having medical school expansion on programs like the Prime program, is important. The other thing we've learned in this last year and a half of examining this issue statewide is that we need a lot more residency programs and internship programs so that people going into the medical field, people going into becoming a doctor, can get training in the rural areas. And there's a lot more clinics and hospitals that provide and are funded to provide the residency and the experience so that they're comfortable with, when they come out of medical school, they're already comfortable with working in a rural area. They already understand it. Yeah, it is different than working in an urban setting, in terms of, especially in terms of being, if you're a primary care doc, a lot of times you need to have specialty care to back you up. You'll have patients that will have more complicated illnesses or diseases. And so you'll want them to already understand how to deal with that. California, we're moving forward on telehealth. That's a way of de-isolating, providing more specialty care and access to specialty care. We're providing other kinds of incentive programs to specialists to help support programs. And then there's programs like the UCSF program, where specialists literally come from places like the UCSF NICU Center, the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, come out to the Central Valley and help provide specialty care so that primary care doctors in those areas feel less isolated.
Dr. Dizon, you heard him mention the UCSF program. What else can you add to as far as what is being done to try to increase the number of doctors in the Central Valley?
Correct. Thanks, Senator. There is hope. I just want to say I agree completely with Mr. Barrow when he said there is a pipeline. I am a primary care physician. I'm trained in internal medicine. It takes 8 years, which include college, medical school, and another 3 years, so a total of 11 years to train somebody like myself or a family physician or pediatrician. So UCSF Fresno actually 8 years ago started a program called Doctors Academy. So UCSF and the Doctors Academy started with Dr. Catherine Flores, where we went into the local high school, Sunnyside.
Sunnyside.
So you've heard Sunnyside, training, mentoring high school students right from first year. And in fact, it's so successful that now we've started the Junior Doctors Academy. We actually start with middle school right now. So if you think about it, Juanita, you have middle school, you have high school, then you have the college system, Fresno State. We have a residency, which is 3 years at least. And then we have something called fellowship, which is training specialists. So the only thing that's lacking there is, I agree, a medical school. And we in the UCSF Fresno are in full support of the UC Merced, UC Davis Prime Program. In fact, Dr. Voris, our associate dean, has worked in conjunction with the dean of College of Letters and Sciences over there over the past 2 to 3 years. And in fact, we were in Sacramento just a year ago trying to let them know that this needs to be done sooner. They're predicting maybe a standalone school by 2020. And when we told them it takes 11 years to train, we need it by 2016.
And isn't part of the problem that you talk about a lot of this, either retaining the doctors having to do with the fact that cost, because of the low and reimbursement fees for Medi-Cal, and different things like that. They, you know, they're not making a lot of money, and they could go someplace else and do that. But also the cost of medical school. And Assemblyman Perea has introduced legislation to create a scholarship program to provide up to $105,000 for medical school students who agree to practice medicine in some of these rural areas or designated medically underserved areas, as they are called.
We have some really good programs in place, and that's one of the areas. Besides the legislators' new bill to help increase loan funds, but we also have the Song Brown funds, which are focused on primary care, not just on docs, but also on auxiliary nurses, physician assistants. But that can help with the loan repayment. Some docs come out of school literally with a $200,000 debt, and then when you think about practicing in an underserved area where, you're right, the reimbursement rates are too low for the kind of practice you're doing, it takes forever to pay off that loan. So there's also the Stephen Thompson Fund at the California Medical Association that was set up to help specifically doctors and primary care doctors get loan repayment grants to help them if they're going to work in underserved areas. There's the Health Professional Education Fund under the Office of Statewide Health Development and Planning, OSHPD. So we have several pots of money. We need to grow those pots of money, and there's good ideas about how to grow those and double the amounts of money in those.
Okay, we're very pleased and lucky to have Assemblyman Perea take time out of his busy schedule at the state capitol to join us now and to talk more about the legislation that he has authored. Assemblyman Perea, first of all, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And in your legislation right now, where is it and what are your hopes in getting that passed? And tell us a little bit about what is behind that.
Well, we've gotten the bill, AB 589, out of the Assembly and is now in Senate Appropriations. And so assuming we can get it through the Senate Appropriations, it'll be on the Senate floor within the next 2 weeks. What we're trying to do is really grow one of the programs that you were just talking about that has been very successful, and that is the Stephen M. Thompson Loan Repayment Program. What we're finding is one of the biggest challenges for access to care in the Valley is just having enough health professionals to actually do the job. And now with the federal Health Care Reform Act that is going to be pushing millions of dollars throughout the state and throughout the Valley, it's an opportunity for us to try to do as much as we can to grow the number of health care professionals in the Valley. So we see this bill as an opportunity to do that. It's sponsored by the California Medical Association. And we think we got a good shot at getting it out and getting it onto the governor's desk.
You know, we do have a lot of great efforts going on right now, but I'd like to ask you all, I mean, how could our own state money problems, our budget problems, impact what we have in the pipeline and what we're trying to do? Because in a way, we're almost defeating the purpose. We say we need more doctors, but then we turn around and we cut and we make it difficult for that to happen.
Well, this is definitely. This is definitely one of the. I mean, that's one of the biggest challenges we're facing in Sacramento. That there just really is not enough money to do everything that we want to do. But at the end of the day, growing the number of health professionals for the state and for the Valley has to be one of our top priorities, and that's why I introduced the bill. Because I do think we have a lot of good programs that are out there. But we need to expand those programs, and that's what I'm looking to do with AB 589.
Well, we're almost out of time, but before we go, Mr. Barrow, I know that you had some information. Not only if we had enough medical personnel here in this area right now, how would that impact, you think, our unemployment problem? Because I tell you, a lot of the jobs that I see coming across are all about the medical field.
Yeah, well, the healthcare workforce in rural California, and especially in the Central Valley, is 11% of the workforce. To give you an idea about how that juxtaposes other kinds of workforce in rural areas Agriculture accounts for statewide 9% of the workforce, and K through 12 education accounts for 10%. So, like those other fields, healthcare is a very important economic factor in the rural areas. If you think about a community with a clinic or a critical access hospital, those are very small hospitals, those usually provide 100 or more jobs in that community. And so we have to be very careful in the rural areas, although that might be the only clinic, it might be the only hospital. So we have to be very careful if there are any cuts that come down through federal government or a state government. We have to be very careful, because if you cut a program that either undermines the employment, doctors, or the ability to have a hospital, then you could actually impact not just losing those 100 jobs or more in that community, but studies have shown that you can also, the non-health retail in that community can drop 28%. That ripples out and costs jobs in other sectors. So the good thinking, like in the bill we were talking about, 589, that's very good thinking. We need to get money into those loan programs. We also need our economic development at the local level and state level, the groups that are working on economic development, to understand that healthcare is one of those job sectors. We believe that in the Central Valley, if we just took care of all the shortages and the disparities we see in our healthcare workforce shortages, we could reduce unemployment in the Central Valley by 1% to 2%.
Okay.
That's pretty significant.
Very significant. Well, folks, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank all of you for joining us for this discussion this morning. Very enlightening. We're going to take a break. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Okay, what are we talking about this week? Well, many students head back to class not only next week, but a good number start a school this week. And more parents, charter schools are becoming an option. Now, do they offer a better learning experience, or is there little difference when it comes to how students perform academically? That is one of the debates or school of thoughts. Joining me is Dave Childers. He is the executive director and principal of Excel Fresno Charter High School, one of the newer charter schools here in Fresno. How long have you been up and running?
We just finished our second year in a couple weeks, year three.
Tell me a little bit more about the charter school and its philosophy.
Well, our charter school's got a very revolutionary philosophy in terms of we're doing a lot of things that are quite opposite of what the traditional public schools are doing right now. So we're a project-based learning environment, no textbooks, completely open-source curriculum. And so I think those two things really are what make us stand out in terms of our approach to not only assessment but delivery as well.
Excel stands for?
It's the Academy for Civic and Entrepreneurial Leadership.
And you're located downtown, correct?
Absolutely. We're Tulare and H, right behind the Greyhound, and kind of adjacent to Chickchansey Stadium.
Okay. What has the growth been for you when you first started as far as students? Now, when it comes to a school like yours, this is something that parents, this has to be a choice for them. They decide, okay, I like this program, I like this option, this is the way I'm going to go.
Yeah, absolutely. We are a choice school, and we're open to anybody in the county or actually any adjoining counties. And this year, we actually will have our first, I would believe, out-of-county students, since we have one student coming from Madera. So that's a landmark for us. And you're right. It's something that parents have to kind of seek out. Obviously, we do a lot of public relations and marketing as much as our budget would allow. But at the end of the day, you know, students and parents choose to come and go as they please. And that's kind of what's great about a charter school is it's an option that, you know, wasn't there several years ago besides just your neighborhood school.
We also have Dr. Michelle Cantwell-Kofer. She's administrator, educational services at the Fresno County Office of Education. And the last I checked, Michelle, there were 33 charter schools now operating in Fresno County, and I know that may have changed because they seem to pop up every year.
No, that number is accurate.
What is the Office of Education, what is your philosophy about charter schools?
Well, we're very supportive of charter schools because we're in the business of supporting all public school children in Fresno County. And we want our schools, all of our schools, to be as successful as possible to benefit our children. So we are very supportive and actually even have a charter schools unit in place to provide not just oversight, but rather support and resource as well.
What do you think parents should look for in a charter school? I'll ask both of you that question, starting with you, Michelle.
Charter schools are a choice opportunity, so I think most parents who are seeking charter schools are looking for something different than the status quo, and often they're interested in a charter school for the special offerings. Perhaps it's a trade or a career connection, or it is a special emphasis, curriculum emphasis such as arts or sciences. And so parents that understand that their children have a particular interest or passion may be seeking out a school that focuses in those areas.
And what do you think?
I don't know how much more I can add. That was fantastic.
Yeah, but when parents in town, but also shouldn't they look at how the school is run? I mean, many of the charter schools here in Fresno County operate just fine, but we've also had some that closed or had to be closed. So parents should I would assume, really kind of look at the leadership and the administration and the program itself.
I would agree. I think I would never advise a parent to send a student to a school they haven't visited. I mean, visiting the school is I think, number one on the list, because you could hear a lot, you could read a lot, you can look at different things, but you really need to get a feel for the environment and to make sure that it's a good fit. And that's what we stress with charter schools. It's that we're not the solution for everybody. We're a solution for a certain type of student and a certain type of parent. And if that fit isn't good, then it's not going to be productive for anybody. And I think that another thing I would say is look at the board, because every charter school has its own board. Every independent charter school has its own board. And that'll give you an idea usually of the philosophy of where the school is coming from. And, you know, in addition to the on-site leadership, you know, that can change quite often. But I think, you know, generally your board is a little more stable and provides the direction for the school. So that's a really important component that not a lot of people, I think, consider enough.
Also, do charter schools impact the local schools? I mean, there's always been somewhat of a concern. Some school districts have expressed concern that perhaps, you know, that the charter schools were taking students away and kind of decreasing their enrollment. But is that something that we've really seen?
Yes. And that is probably the number one concern of the traditional public school, is that particularly in our community, when decreased enrollment is prevalent in many of our school districts, a charter school that provides choice could indeed help impact, if you will, that decreased enrollment status.
But also when it comes to from what I have read, so far studies indicate academically there is very little difference between when it comes to testing, public schools and charter schools.
Are you referring to student test results?
Yes.
Okay. There, just as in any time you look at test results, there are a lot of – it's very difficult to make a general statement about whether or not a school is good or not based on simply student's performance. The Fresno County Office of Education is an oversight authority for some of our charter schools. And when we provide that responsibility to supervise and evaluate the successful performance of a charter school, we look at a number of criteria. Student performance relative to similar schools in the same area, neighborhood, for example, is the criteria that we would measure to determine whether or not students are making progress academically.
Also, I would like to remind our listeners that you can join in the conversation, especially any of you who've had charter school experience or thinking about sending your child to charter school. We have two great guests here right now. You can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll free at 800-224-8989 or online at kvpr.org to let us know about your charter school experience. Before enrolling their child in a charter school, you mentioned parents should visit the school. Now, how many students right now do you have at Excel?
Right now we're showing about 140 going in. We don't start till September 6th, so we have a couple weeks more. So we're really hoping to get to about 150. We only will have 9th through 11th grade this coming year. Then we have one more year before we add the 9th through 12th, and we're a full-service high school. So and we've grown considerably. We were under 60 in the first year with just 9th grade, so it's been a major learning experience for us each year, adding a new grade level and other new students as well, and kind of changing demographics at the same time.
Okay. And Dr. Catmull Cofer, when we look at the charter schools, you were saying that right now there's no difference in, it's all by choice what a parent might be looking for in a charter school. What are some of the schools that are now through the Fresno County Office of Education that have specialties? A lot of them do have specialties.
Yes, we, in fact, for a parent who has an interest in a particular area of academics, we would encourage them to visit our website. As I said, there are 33 schools available under charter with different authorizers, by the way. Fresno County Office of Ed authorizes 5, but many other school districts have provide oversight to their individual charter schools. But a parent who has a particular interest in, say, math or science really wants to research which schools would offer that type of focus.
We have Jen joining us from Fresno, and she wants to know, Jen, what is your question?
My question is about racial integration and how the charter schools are impacting that. Since charter schools are selecting their kids based only on their school, what is that doing for racial integration in the bigger districts, Fresno Unified, for example, and for the county as a whole?
Well, I think first thing we need to point out is that charter schools don't select students. Students apply to the school. If you have more applications and you have space, then you hold a lottery, which is completely unbiased. Generally speaking, I think in our area we see a really good deal of diversity in charters. I know my school in particular has a higher percentage of language learners and special needs students than the district as a whole that we are authorized by. So I think that's definitely a misconception that's out there that there's some kind of selection process that goes on at the charters. It's not us going out and picking students. It's students applying and then lotteries if you have more apps than spaces.
But that is one of the – I don't want to call it a complaint, but that is one of the concerns that I read about was that especially how charter schools fare academically, it was stated that – when it comes to students, they don't, there aren't a lot of English learners or maybe other students who have, educational challenges. So they don't have to, that doesn't play into the academic test scores.
I think I would counter that, again, we're speaking in general terms. And backing up through the review process, when an individual or a group wants to petition to establish a charter school, they have to complete a lengthy process, and they have to meet 16 required elements. Those elements start with an educational program and end with things like procedures for how they will function as a school. But one of those required elements is racial and ethnic balance. And so at the point of authorization, we seek to be assured that there will be an ethnic and racial balance in the school.
Okay. Well, I thank you both for joining us this morning. There's a lot to talk about there, and maybe we will at another time. We'll be back in just a moment. You are listening to Valley Edition. Welcome back to Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson. Philip Levine has always been Fresno's Poet Laureate. Last week, he was named Poet Laureate of the United States, just one more of the many honors he has been awarded, including a Pulitzer Prize. We were just plain lucky to have Mr. Levine move to Fresno in 1958 and began teaching at Fresno State, and we are thrilled that he agreed to join us on Valley Edition. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on your latest honor.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, what does this latest honor to be named the nation's Poet Laureate, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's nice. It's you could say it's the icing on the cake, but it isn't the cake. It isn't, you know, what sustained me all these years. It's nice to have, and I'll use the opportunity as best I can. And I appreciate it, and I'm pleased by the Library of Congress. They gave it to me. Their confidence in my work and their interest in my work and their interest in what I write about, which is so much of it is urban poetry, much of it centered around the city of Detroit where I grew up, and a good deal of it about the valley and its goods and its evils.
You were saying, you said it's not the cake. What is the cake?
Oh, the cake is what keeps you alive, and the cake is actually the writing of the work itself, I would say, comes first, and the satisfaction that you get from doing something you want to do and doing it at times, doing it very well. It's also, you know, for me, another cake was teaching, especially here at Fresno State, where I had wonderful students who went on to spectacular careers in writing and in teaching, and many of them became among my closest friends. And then through poetry, I made wonderful friends. Two of them live here in Fresno. Three, four, I can think of. Two that I worked with, Charles Hanzlicek and Peter Everwine, they became lifelong friends. John Weinberg and Dixie Salazar, and some have passed from life, you know, like Luis Omar Salinas, and Ernesto Trejo, a magnificent human being, who taught for a while at City College and died when he was only about 40. So that's what sustained me: friendship, love, and the work itself.
What is it, or was it, about Fresno State students you say that you really enjoyed and really loved, because you have taught at some very notable universities?
Yes, I have. I taught at, you know, Brown and Princeton and Columbia and New York University, Vanderbilt, UC Berkeley. The students here, for one thing, they reminded me of the very students that I went to college with as a young guy in Detroit. These were like the rural counterparts of those people. They worked for a living. They worked to make their tuition. They worked, you know, they came many from working class families. And, you know, when I taught at Princeton, for example, students had a very difficult time taking criticism about their writing. They had never failed in an academic setting. And when I told them that what they were writing, a given poem, I'd say, well, these three lines are quite nice, but this has to be, throw this stuff away. It's no good. It's trite. I had a student, I remember very clearly, at Tufts, another one at Vassar, and another one at Princeton, literally weep in class, make me feel like, you know, I was a little Hitler or something. And no one ever did that at Fresno State. The students at Fresno State, they knew how to fail. They could take criticism and grow from it. If I said to a Fresno State student, these four lines are really interesting, you can build out the introduction is corny and you don't end it right, but let's work on these lines, you got the tone right here, I'd look at them and they'd be smiling. They'd say, oh, terrific. I said, that's poetry. What you're writing right there is poetry. And if you can write that much poetry, you can be a poet. And so it was so rewarding to help these people. It was thrilling.
Well, maybe because they would take a look at you, and either the criticism or the encouragement or whatever you want to call it was coming from Phil Levine, and that could have made the difference for them.
It didn't do that at Princeton.
What are you looking forward to the most about being the Poet Laureate?
That's a good question. Well, one of the things has already happened. My books have sold out. There's an article today in the New York Times saying there are no books left at Amazon. There are no books left at Barnes & Noble. Bookstores in New York City are sold out. The publisher has called me, said, we're reprinting. We'll have them back in 6 or 7 days. Don't worry. Man, I never sold like that. So the publicity from this thing has been, you know, far vaster than anything I've ever received before. And I like that. Also, it'll give me a chance to speak about the kind of person that I admire. Those courageous, affectionate, tough, gnarly people I grew up with. Some from my family, some from my neighbors, and some from the places where I worked. Who I've tried to celebrate in my writing and reflect honestly who they were. And I can talk about the kind of life I came from, and hopefully I can touch young poets and encourage them to stay with it. Let them know it can be done, even if you come from a place like Detroit or you come from a place like Fresno and you don't have the kind of connections, you don't go to the Ivy schools, but you can still do it.
Growing up in Detroit and working in the plants there, it has had a great influence on your writing.
Yeah, it's very ironic because when I was there, I left Detroit at age 26. When I was there, most of the work I had was pretty exhausting. Work in America wasn't automated to the degree that it is now. In fact, the two big automotive factories I worked in, nothing was automated. And so I would come home. I preferred to work either afternoons or nights. You know, we had three shifts. And then I'd get my sleep and I'd get up and I would have hours to write. But so often, I was so weary and spent that I didn't do much writing. And I thought, if I stick in this life, these jobs are going to prevent me from ever becoming the poet I want to be. And the irony is, once I got out of there and went into teaching at age 30, those years turned out to be so powerful in what I would then write about. I couldn't write about it when I was there in Detroit. I didn't even try. Because it was like talking shop, you know? If you work in a jewelry store all day, you don't want to go home and talk about jewelry. If you're a dentist, do you want to go home and talk about people's teeth? So I didn't write about it. And then when I was no longer there, I had difficulty writing about it because the anger was just too strong. And about the age of 35, I had a dream. This will sound nuts. I had a dream in which a guy I worked with, whose picture actually sits above my desk, called me from Southern California. And in the dream, I could see him in a phone booth with a car parked there. And we were communicating, and he was asking me about where should he go in California. And I started telling him about things in L.A. and the beach and the this and the that. But in the dream, secretly, I knew what he was waiting for was an invitation to come and see me. And in the dream, I didn't give him that invitation. And we said goodbye. And in the dream, I saw him walking back to his car. And then I woke up. And I was very angry at myself. I said, what the hell you think you are? You with your assistant professorship at a second-rate college are so snooty you're going to cut yourself off from your past? That is disgraceful. And I got back in bed with a pad of paper and a board that I used to write on to support the paper. And for 6 days, I wrote poems about Detroit, and they were the first really good poems I wrote about Detroit. And I suddenly realized that's That's what I was meant to write. That realization came slowly, but the poems came quickly, and they were good. They're all in my second book, Not This Pig. They're all there. And they were the first truly good poems I wrote about the conditions we face, the people I face them with. And I realized then how much those people meant to me and how kind they'd been, how accepting. It was an absolutely wonderful experience.
I read somewhere where you call the Valley the rural counterpart of Detroit. What do you think makes these two cities similar?
I was really thinking of the social structure. In Detroit, you were aware of, and this is the Detroit of 1,800,000 people, and the auto industry thriving, you know, before good cars arrived from overseas. There were 1,700,000 of us who did the work. And maybe there were a few hundred or thousand who took away most of the profits. And it was very clear that if things didn't change drastically in the way Americans relate to society, the 1,700,000 of us would stay exactly where we were, or worse, we could lose our jobs. And those at the top would stay where they are, getting richer and richer. And it was something I resented enormously. I knew working in a factory that I was being exploited. I wasn't making that kind of money, never making enough to save enough to do anything. When I came out here, there was a mythology about who we were. You know, we were Polacks. You know, we were lazy. You know, we were Negroes. That's the word we used then. We were lazy. We were ignorant. We were hillbillies. You know, there was all this mythology about who we were and how useless essentially we were and how we belong exactly where we are. I came out here, and the same thing existed. There was a very small class of people who owned the place, vast farms, and a sort of auxiliary of people, some of them without even getting citizenship, who worked and worked and worked and bore the same kind of reputations: stupid, lazy, no resourcefulness, easily led into crime, drug habits. I mean, it was the same damn thing all over again in another setting. And, of course, it's American capitalism. It's what it does. Its effort is to reduce these working people to the status of peons so that those who are doing well don't have to feel, hey, that could be me.
You know, when you speak about that, you can't help but to think about where we are today. And so when you think about work and you think about all the people we have out of work today and people not, or it appears people aren't doing what needs to be done to get jobs created, what are your thoughts on that?
A certain degree of rage re-enters my life. To think about, you know, government policies that seem to have no recognition of what unemployment could really mean, to have no recognition of how one feels having to accept food stamps, what this does to the dignity of men and women who were gifted by their creator with great dignity and whose society is slowly attempting to rob them of that dignity. It's heartbreaking. And you can't help but feel it if you're a feeling person.
One of your more noted pieces is about work. And during our conversation, you said it came out of a frustrating experience of having to stand in line in the rain for the opportunity to apply for a job. Do you mind reading that poem for us?
What work is? We stood in the rain in a long line, waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting, shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course, someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today," for any reason he wants. You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him, held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek? You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No. Just because you don't know what work is.
Mr. Levine, thank you.
Well, thank you.
I could listen to you all day.
Well, it was a great pleasure to talk to you.
And that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Kaiser Permanente, and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.